It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original, fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
How can you lose track of a few trillion dollars? Well, try getting the politicians riled up about a few hundred million dollars. Now, there's a pretty wide spread between a few hundred million and a couple of trillion. Just for the record, picture a 2 followed by 12 zeros. That's what our government has been shoveling out this week, while lawmakers are telling those AIG folks to fork it over. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
American Public Media presents Repossessing Virtue. Engage with wise voices on the economic downturn from moral and ethical perspectives at speakingoffaith.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Glad to have you with us on this Thursday, the 19th of March. The government has spent more than a year wrestling with ways to handle a financial crisis, and it took the House of Representatives just a few days to take action against those AIG executives. It voted today to slap a 90% federal tax on the $165 million in bonuses awarded to current and former AIG workers. It would apply to executives whose incomes exceed $250,000. That measure would still need to be reconciled with the Senate's version, which would put a tax of 70% on those bonuses. Senate leaders are promising a vote on their version before their scheduled recess early next month. Wall Street, meantime, was keeping its focus on a different kind of fallout. Of course, we talk a lot about fallout on this show, the fallout from the financial crisis. Well, today, it was fallout from the Federal Reserve's latest move. Yesterday's announcement that it would increase its balance sheet by $750 billion and use the money to buy more mortgage-backed securities. Add another $100 billion worth of agency debt to the shopping cart as well, and throw in another $300 billion of long-term Treasury bonds. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has this look at the consequences of all that.
The Fed said the moves were designed to provide greater support for mortgage lending, and they did. Holden Lewis of Bankrate.com says rates for most borrowers dropped overnight from about 5.25% to 5%.
What the Fed is wanting to do is to encourage people to refinance so they can save money, spend that money elsewhere, and stimulate the economy.
But print all that money and there's bound to be some impact on the dollar, right? Here's Brian Dolan, chief currency strategist with Forex.com.
We're looking at 3 to 5 percentage points movements in currencies in 24 hours, which is a pretty significant movement.
Dolan says concerns about inflation drove the dollar down by several cents against the euro and the yen. Inflation concerns also tend to impact commodities that are bought and sold in dollars, like gold and oil. On the trading floor in Chicago, Aileron's Phil Flynn says despite weak demand and heavy supply, traders had no choice but to pump up the price of crude.
You can't beat the Fed. They can print dollars faster than I can. So now, for me to bet on lower oil prices, it's a lot more of a dangerous proposition, no matter how dreary I think the demand outlook is.
Now, these things might seem like unpleasant side effects of the Fed's action. I mean, the Fed never stated a desire to drive up oil prices. But former Fed economist Morris Davis, now at the University of Wisconsin, says they know just what they're doing.
The Fed wants to inflate. So the increase in the price of oil and the devaluation of the dollar, that is an intended consequence.
No surprise to anyone who's been listening to Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke recently. He said he's more concerned with deflation than inflation. Davis says the worry now is once printing money is the strategy, how do you know when to stop? In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
You almost can't keep all these government fixes straight without a scorecard. So we've called in Kevin Flanagan to bring us up to date. He's a money market strategist with Morgan Stanley. Thanks for helping us out.
Thanks for having me.
For those who haven't been following every twist and turn this week, help us understand, if you will, the various programs that the government has put in place now. My mom would like to know, what are all these actions she's been hearing about, and what do they all mean?
It's a great way of putting it. But really what we've come down to now, the most important announcement, perhaps the most momentous of it all, was what occurred yesterday with the Fed's decision to increase their balance sheet by almost $1.2 trillion. And within the process, what the Fed's trying to do is to buy mortgage-backed securities as well as treasuries in the open market. Now, this is all intended to sort of kickstart the housing market, to perhaps create or fuel a new wave of potential refinancing activity. So this is sort of a 1-2 punch by the Fed to not only continue buying these mortgage-backed securities, but also buying treasury securities as well in an attempt to make sure they can bring mortgage rates down even further from the levels that we're seeing at this point in time.
Well, let me bring up some of those acronyms, the TARP and the TALF and those sorts of programs, this latest move by the Fed. How does that fit with the big bailout, if you will, the TARP?
Well, I think what we're the Fed and the Treasury Department and the FDIC has been trying to do is use all of the means at their disposal. And instead of sort of looking to do one step at a time, seeing what's working or seeing what hasn't been working, this appears to be an attempt now to use everything in your arsenal and try to come up with the optimal result. Now, this program, TALF, which is an asset-backed lending facility, it's a way for the Fed to make things easier for this market to get back to a better sense of normalcy, only got started this week. So we don't even know where this program will be taking us down the road. And that's why I thought maybe the Fed would want to wait before they embark on another ambitious program. But obviously, you know, the Fed decided to come at it with both barrels blazing.
Well, to paraphrase that old saying, a trillion here, a trillion there, pretty soon it adds up and turns into real money. Do we have any sense of how much has been spent so far now?
Up to this point, the Fed has probably grown their balance sheet in the area of, I would say, close to $2 trillion. With respect to the government involvement, you know, you were looking at the Troubled Asset Relief Program, the TARP. That was a $700 billion program. The FDIC has gotten involved as well and is looking for a potential another $500 billion down the road. So, you know, as you say, it is mounting. It is building up.
We know there's no precedent for a lot of what they're trying. How much does this amount to printing money and throwing it at the problem? And should we expect more spending?
Well, it is certainly, you know, printing money and to some extent throwing it at the problem. The Fed would probably argue vehemently that they're not throwing it at the problem, that they're targeting what they view as areas that need the help, the assistance, the stimulus. But, you know, you can make the case if you go down this road and you're not getting your desired results. And that's the key word, I think, desired results, that, you know, maybe you did throw some money at this, that it wasn't necessarily just a targeted approach. You know, the Fed, the $300 billion in buying treasuries, that may not be the end of it.
Kevin Flanagan is a money market strategist with Morgan Stanley. Thanks for your insights.
Thank you very much.
And back to Washington. It's not every day that a corporate executive heads to Capitol Hill, makes a public appearance before Congress, and says, "Regulate my industry, please." Well, that's what David McKay did today. He runs a company you may have heard of, Kellogg's. Along with a lot of other companies, not to mention consumers, the big food maker has been burned by the recent salmonella outbreak in peanuts. The Kellogg CEO has decided the country's food safety system is broken, and today he told Congress so. Marketplace's Steve Henn has the story.
Peanut butter sales have plummeted as parents across the country pull peanut butter cookies and PB&J sandwiches out of their kids' lunches.
You know, unfortunately, I'm still not confident about the safety of peanut products.
Sarah Klein is a staff attorney at the Center for Science in the Public Interest.
This outbreak continues to grow. We've seen over 2,000 products that have been recalled, and the list grows every day.
Kellogg's had to recall 7 million cases of tainted cookies. And today, the company's CEO, David McKay, told Congress it cost the company a bundle.
Currently, our estimation is between $65 and $70 million.
McKay said the country's food safety system is broken. Right now, companies like Kellogg's require suppliers to conduct safety audits and send the results. But Kellogg's uses 7,000 ingredients every year and buys from 3,000 different firms. Since the Salmonella outbreak, it and most other big food buyers have done their own audits. Their suppliers...
They're running so many audits, they actually can't produce the product we all want. So if we could get great standards we can all rely on, it would be better for everyone.
Sarah Klein at the Center for Science and the Public Interest couldn't be happier.
A lot of the things that Kellogg proposed today are things that we have been supporting for a long time.
McKay asked Congress to create one agency responsible for regulating all foods, require annual federal inspections, and ensure that this new agency has the budget it needs. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Seems the Fed's latest moves to get investors back in the saddle might have pushed them right on over to the other side today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The feds are making peace with pot, or at least medical marijuana dispensaries. The official word has come down from the Obama administration. Attorney General Eric Holder says the Justice Department won't prosecute marijuana clinics, which are operating legally in California and a dozen other states. This is a big change in terms of federal policy, but does it signal high times for the quasi-legit medicinal pot industry? Here's Marketplace's Jeff Tyler.
Is the Obama administration paving the way for medical marijuana to become a legitimate business? Bruce Merkin thinks so. He's the spokesman for the Marijuana Policy Project, which is committed to ending pot prohibition.
This change is going to help bring what had been a semi-underground business out of the shadows into a fully regulated, tax-paying part of our state.
Sales of medical marijuana are legal under California state law, but illegal under federal law. Merkin says the threat of federal prosecution has kept part of the industry underground.
Many of the medical marijuana dispensaries in California have been paying taxes. Many of them have wanted to but been afraid to.
Merchants were concerned about having tax payments confiscated by the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency.
They literally took tax money on legally dispensed medical marijuana that was destined for the state of California and seized it.
The Justice Department's new stance should stop the seizures. It may also give hope to people who support legalizing the sale of pot. Some advocates estimate marijuana could generate $1 billion a year in taxes. But that may be optimistic. Rosalie Pakula is co-director of RAND's Drug Policy Research Center.
There's a lot of speculation about the size of that market, but I don't think we have very good data.
Without the threat of federal prosecution, medical marijuana clubs may finally open the books and give economists a better idea of just how much their industry is worth. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
The world is going through a lot of changes right now, some temporary, some not, and some who knows. We talked earlier about all the ways the government's trying to fix all the trouble we're in, but when we get to the other side of these difficult times, and we will, what will we call this situation, this period in history? Commentator and economist Justin Wolfers has been looking for an answer.
The pundits are calling it a financial crisis, but the economy has been bad enough for long enough that we can't keep labeling it a crisis. Officially, it's a recession. But recessions are typically short and mild, and we've already been in this recession for over a year. Still, things aren't as bad as they were in the 1930s, so we can't call it a depression. So what should we call it? I asked a bunch of economists and got some great ideas. David Klingensmith from Case Western noted that in 1930, Keynes used the term great slump. The only downside? It's not very poetic. Especially for him. My Wharton colleague, Jeremy Tabakman, was more dramatic, suggesting we call it the decline and fall, which hints at the financial empires that were built on paper and false promises. He's referencing the history of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, which attributes the empire's decay to the ruinous sloth brought on by years of success. The empire fell when Romans outsourced their defense to mercenaries. Replace the mercenaries with the ratings agencies, and you have the whole story. My significant other, economist Betsy Stevenson, suggests we call it the Great Correction, to reflect both the cause of the downturn and its magnitude. But correction suggests we're reverting to the correct level of economic activity. There's just too many people out of work for any of this to be correct. But Professor Stevenson says she means the Great Correction as a request. It's time to correct lax regulation. If this was the cause, maybe we should call it the Great Deception instead. Perhaps the best idea comes from Darren Fitzgerald, an Irish economist at Stanford. She suggests we call it a clump, short for credit slump, or a flump, which denotes a financial slump. As she said, flump has a pleasing whiff of incompetence about it. This language lays bare the ineptitude of policymakers who failed to recognize a clump of flumps. So let's keep our fingers crossed that soon enough this incompetence will end. And let's hope that the economy will emerge from its terrible, what do we call it? Flump.
Harumph. Justin Wolfers teaches business and public policy at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. We welcome your thoughts at marketplace.org. Coming up in the latest installment of our series, Working, we meet a human smuggler from Afghanistan.
They come in the guest house over there. Then we just take them to Taftan between Iran and Pakistan. It's the border town.
But first, let's do the numbers. Profit-taking and worries over inflation put a crimp on the markets today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average shed 85 points, or just over 1%, to close at 7,400. The NASDAQ dropped 7 points, about 0.5%, to finish at 1483. The S&P 500 slid 10 points, or 1.3%, to end at 784. Investors in J.P. Morgan Chase decided to cash in on gains made earlier this week and sent the bank shares down almost 8%. Goldman Sachs also took a tumble, dropping about 5.5%. Shares of 3M lost some of their adhesive. The Dow component dropped more than 3.5% on predictions of weaker short-term sales. Investors in Europe were in a better mood. French and British indices both closed higher, 0.3% or more. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note recovered a bit to 2.6%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on fallout from the financial crisis, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The House Financial Services Committee looks at ways to protect investors from financial fraud. President Obama is scheduled to meet with New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg and California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger in Washington. And meals around the globe go meatless. Organizers of the annual Meat Out say kick the meat habit for a day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Can you imagine this? Last year, the country of Iran deported as many as 1,000 illegal aliens per day back to Afghanistan. Iran is one of the most popular destinations for Afghans desperate for work or fed up with everyday violence. And many of those who want to go further, to Europe and other places, have to pass through Iran to get where they're going. But even as that frontier becomes a more difficult route, Afghans can try exiting stage right through Pakistan. Each month, our series Working introduces us to a single worker in the global economy. For our next story, we sent Gregory Warner to Pakistan to meet a human smuggler.
For every once-in-a-lifetime experience, there's always someone who does it every day. Think of skydiving instructors or Sherpas who'll take you up Everest for a price. And it's the same thing with smuggling. If you're an Afghan and you need to sneak out of the country to find a paycheck or some security, it is like climbing Everest. It's arduous and risky and expensive. But if you're a professional like Ali Dad, it's routine. First, he meets the people he's smuggling at a prearranged spot.
They come in the guest house over there. Then we just take them to Taftan between Iran and Pakistan. It's the border town.
I met Ali Dad in Quetta, Pakistan, just 11 hours from the Iranian border. A lot of smugglers are based here, because while it's easy for Afghans to sneak into Pakistan, a few bucks to a border guard will do it, the border to Iran is tougher to cross. So people call Ali Dad.
People that are coming from Afghanistan, either they know us or they actually have a friend that are relatives of us, and they just come here, contact us, and that's how we do it.
Ali Dad looks kind of like the guy you meet in the park playing dominoes. He's 62 with white hair and a weather-beaten face. He doesn't think he's doing anything wrong. He says he's just providing a service. And he smiles when I ask if he's in the mafia.
It's not mafia. We are not smuggling drugs or kidnapping people. That's mafia. We're not.
I ask Ali Dad to smuggle me over, and he refuses. Too dangerous. But he does agree to recreate the experience. The trip begins here, at the outdoor bus station outside the city. In the middle of the asphalt, a ticket seller sits at his metal desk. Behind him are Pakistani buses in bright hippie colors. These are the buses to the Iranian border. My translator sticks a tape recorder in his shirt pocket. And then he and Ali Dad walk past the ticket seller and straight up to a bus driver. How much to the border, they ask. The driver says, do you have a passport? If you do, it's $6. If you don't, it's 30. The extra is for the driver to bribe the cops along the road.
It is a bribe's work, so we just bribe the police.
When they get to the border comes the hard part. Ali Dad will smuggle 20 to 60 people at a time on a two-week trek through the mountains to find an illegal crossing. He'll charge about $350 for the service, $300 of which go to bribes. Still, half the cost of a visa. In the mountains, you move by night and hide by day. There's little food, and if you get sick, Ali Dad has only plants to offer.
This grass is good for stomach pain, constipation, all that.
This is pretty tasty, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Tastes like... A bit minty.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you then, have you ever used any of these grasses to, you know, help somebody or save somebody's life even? Plenty of times, Ali Dad says. Other times, though, there was nothing he could do. People weaken. They get hypothermia.
We used to hit these mountains with all the snow and it was cold, fall off the mountain, people died and... You used to go in the creeks to hide from the police and all that stories. I mean, those are the really sad memories of my life.
Of all the people who earn money from the smuggling economy, the crooked cops, the safe houses along the way, Ali Dad, the actual smuggler, earns the least. And he takes the most risk. He spent 10 of the last 30 years in Iranian prisons.
They beat us up, and we have to pay the police to get us out of the prison as soon as possible and make us go over the border.
So why do you keep doing it? Is it worth it?
We don't have any business here. We don't have shops over here. We don't have vehicles. So we just do it for the money.
I ask Ali Dad why, if it's about the money, he never smuggled himself. Stay in Iran and find work there. He says his family is here, his kids are here. What made Ali Dad a good smuggler is that he's a homebody. His son works in a bakery, and when Ali Dad's not trekking through mountains, you'll find him here working the front counter. The oven is a pit in the floor. His son slaps the dough into the brick sides with his hand, and then he scrapes it off again with a giant spatula. I lean over to watch the process, and Ali Dad makes a joke about me falling in. He's happy here, selling bread to the customers. If he could, he'd be here full-time.
This job is better for me because I can go home every night and there is no fear.
Ali Dad will never lack for business. In Quetta, I meet many young Afghans desperate to leave. 23-year-old Hamid has slicked back hair and wraparound shades.
Yeah, my name is Hamid. Hotel Alpha, Mike, India, Delta.
He says his name like this because he used to be an interpreter for the U.S. Marines.
I was working like 3.5 years with the Special Forces. I got a lot of enemies in Afghanistan.
You got a lot of enemies in Afghanistan?
Yeah.
Like, because you worked with the Americans?
Yeah.
Hamid came here to Pakistan to find out about smuggling himself away. Smugglers charge more depending on how far you want to go. So Canada costs more than Europe, which costs more than Iran. But America is never an option. It's too hard to get into. Hamid has his heart set on Australia.
Clean city, clean people, and no bomb blast, no killing people. Oh my God, that's nice. I love that.
Hamid is going back to Afghanistan to translation work to try to raise the cash. When he does, Ali Dad the smuggler says he'll try to connect him with the right people.
Yeah, we can arrange that. I know somebody in Iran, somebody in Iran knows somebody in Turkey knows somebody in Europe. That's how it's done. You know, we're connected all.
For now, Ali Dad is in no hurry to get back to the mountains. The bakery is cozy and warm. He counts out the coins from the last batch of bread, rests his head on a bag of flour, and takes a nap.
Gregory Warner went to Pakistan to get that story for us. Our series Working is a collaboration with Homelands Productions. You can see pictures of Ali Dad and the mountain journey on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note. Yo-ho! That might be the greeting come spring for one class at the University of Chicago. The anthropology course, Intensive Study of a Culture, Pirates, has proven to be a pretty popular class. In fact, according to the Chicago Tribune, more undergraduates registered for this class than for almost any other. It begins March 30th, and although Pirates of the Caribbean will be studied, it won't be all Blackbeard and Captain Jack Sparrow. Music and software pirates, and even old Bernie Madoff will be part of the curriculum. Aye, matey. And here is one more sign of the times for you. A landlord with apartments in Ohio, Florida, North Carolina, and Texas is promising 2 months of free rent if its tenants lose their job. The layoff-proof lease program will begin Saturday. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 85 points, just over 1%, to close at 7,400. The Nasdaq dropped 7 points, about 0.5%, to finish at 1483. And the S&P 500 shed 10 points, or 1.3%, to end at 784. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Hawes, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Next time on the program, a change is coming to Baltimore.
If we slog away at this together, we actually can create something that offers longtime residents the opportunity to stay here if they desire, and at the same time, newcomers to take part in a green, thriving community right in the heart of the city.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join Kai back here for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Soul to Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Soul to Story are available now.